Accession number 33202, Reel 1.
Terry Light, Reel 1. So when and where were you born?
I was born in Bath on the 24th of December 1932, the same day as my wife.
And did you grow up in Bath?
Yes, very much. I'm a proud Bathonian. Born on the other side of the city, that is what we call the north side of the city, the north side of the Avon. Primary school education, secondary school education, all within the city or just outside the city. And then having finished my secondary school education, my career path, much to the surprise of all my relations or everybody I knew, was that I was determined to go into agriculture. No agricultural background, none of my relations were associated with farming. So this new boy, this fresh boy to such a career, had to rethink. So I became what was then known as a working pupil. I was a grammar school boy to start off with, and then decided to switch over to a public school, Mountain Coombe School, which in those days, and here you're going into the 1950s, had the unique situation of having its own farm and its own gardens, primarily to supply milk, meat, flowers, vegetables to the school, to the boarders, although I wasn't a boarder. So you could call it, received my apprenticeship in milking a cow twice a day for 7 days a week, mucking out cows and calves, being taught how to dig a garden for planting of vegetables or flowers from 1950 to about 1953. Now, as a part of my requirement to take an agricultural degree, being from a non-farming background, there was a requirement that I had at least 12 months experience working on farm or farms approved by the education authorities, in other words, the agricultural college where I was going to take this degree. Well, I had a place, but they wouldn't allow me to take the place until I'd done this this hard grafting. So I decided to spread my wings and managed to get a British Council scholarship to live and work on a farm in Denmark, which was a large commercial farm known as Kolla Kolla, about 6 to 8 kilometres north of Copenhagen, and was also an artificial insemination centre for the what was then the primary breed in Denmark at that time, known as Danish Reds. So there I had my baptism of living in a hostel where there was an international fraternity of obviously Danes, Swedes, Canadians, Brits, with my aim, of course, to try and pick up some of the Danish language, because everybody else wanted to speak English. So my knowledge, other than some crude phrases, was very limited in Danish by the time I thought about it after 12 months. But I learnt a great deal. In other words, I was away from home, and there's nothing like getting away from home and being dropped in the deep end.
Just before we go on, because I just want to get a little bit more of a sense of what home life was before you went away to Denmark. So, what did your father do?
Father was clerk of the works and head of handicrafts at a public school on the other side of the city called Kingswood School. And father wanted me to go from grammar school to finish off my sixth form over there. But no way. Who wants to be at a school where your father is well known and also teaches? So it was opportune that at that particular time there was this scheme offered by Monckton Coombe School, which is just outside the city, whereby they offered this scheme, and three of us took it up. The other two were sons of Ministry of Defence officials, Ministry of Defence staff, because as I dare say you will know, the Admiralty, as it was known, and then latterly the Ministry of Defence, moved from London down to Bath and Bristol. So there were three of us there learning our, call it our trade, before going on to higher education. Ian went to Aberystwyth University, Jason went to Harper Adams Agricultural College, I went to the Royal Ag as a starter. So we had to really rough it. It was 7 days working. And our fees for our tuition in taking additional examinations, those days is well before your time, known as higher school cert, were paid for by our labour, topped up by what our parents happened to pay. So it was a very convenient way, from my point of view, although I didn't always appreciate it at the time, of getting into higher education in a career which, within the family, nobody really considered I was suitable for and shouldn't be doing, because the unwritten rule within the family was that I would join my uncle's company, known as Wyman's, latterly taken over by Kent McKenzie's, or Kent, the book-selling people, and go into the retail book sector. But no, thank you, no. So, you know, I went off on my own, as I say. Did my 12 months in Denmark, learned a great deal, and then came home, and of course I was accepted to take my place at the Royal Ag. So away we get there, go into higher education.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
A change, a complete change. Here again, okay, I was living away from home, and the atmosphere at the Royal Ag in those days, going back now into the 1953, was that he worked hard and played hard. The Royal Ag in those particular days, the Royal Agricultural College, it was very much the ethos that you, if you wanted to learn and attend lectures, you did so. If you wanted to play around and go to the races, you could do so as well. Mind you, you might flop in your examinations, but that's your problem. Enjoyable time. As I expect you're aware, you know, got up to the usual pranks of students. And finished my course there successfully in agricultural science. And then I already had a job lined up with an organisation, I suppose these days it would be called a quango, known as the Crown Agents for the Colonies. And they were looking for and appointing what is known as livestock officers for East Africa, principally Uganda, Tanganyika, and Kenya. And the idea was, or my ambition was, that to spend a tour out there of at least 3 years as a livestock officer. The only qualifications that I would have to go through again, other than my agricultural science, would be to learn Swahili, which would have been a bit of a laugh, because I'm no linguist. But as things turned out, plans were completely thrown into disarray, because I came home from North Yorkshire. I'd been staying with a college friend in North Allerton, and I came home and there was a brown envelope on Her Majesty's service. I opened the brown envelope and I'd been nabbed for military service.
And were you expecting that?
No. No way. Hadn't given a thought. I thought, because of my would-be career then in agriculture, I would be exempt, because those working on the land were usually exempt. But somehow it didn't work out that way.
And how did you feel about the letter?
Very upset. Very upset. So in effect, here was going to be an interruption to my planned career. And in that, there's a moral in many ways, you know, plan ahead by all means, but you've got to expect the unexpected. And this was the unexpected. I may say we talked this over with the family and we thought in many ways perhaps we could avoid it, but I think the general consensus was that get it over and done with. So I had to... there was a warrant there, a railway warrant, a one-way one as well, one trip. Go north, young man.
And don't come back.
That's right. And really, I was going back up to where I'd come down from my friends in North Allerton, although my posting on this one-way trip from Bath Station was to York, the fair city of York. And I'd been posted to the Light Infantry Brigade headquarters, Strensel Camp. And there in Strensel Camp, they had what was known as Leader Platoon. And this was the initial training for would-be officers.
That's just sort of... Just talk me through it from... So you get your warrant.
Yeah.
You know you're going.
Yeah. I've got no choice.
You've got no choice.
Yes.
So do you remember the journey?
Not particularly. It was all a haze, I suppose. No, I can't remember the... I do remember arriving at York Station. And I was the only one to... I was told to report to, as I say, Camp Strensel, Leader Platoon, Light Infantry Brigade HQ.
And so when was this?
This would have been July 1955. And there was a truck, soft-sided truck there, with a couple of Light Infantry NCOs. And I was the only one. So I had to jump in this truck and be spoken to like a lump of manure, coin an agricultural phrase, and I was taken to Camp Strensel, which is, I don't know if you know that part of Yorkshire at all, it's out on the Moulton-Scarborough Road, I suppose about 10 miles northeast of the fair city of York. And Strensel then was the training headquarters for all the light infantry regiments, because the light infantry regiments in the 50s were individual county regiments. Somerset Light Infantry, Duke of Cornwall's Light Infantry, Shropshire Light Infantry, Durham Light Infantry, Oxen Bucks Light Infantry, to name five of them. I think there were six or seven of them all told. And the so-called officer potential recruits were drafted into this, or posted into this leader platoon. In addition to light infantry on Strensel Camp, it was also at that time the headquarters for the 1st Battalion, the Green Howards, which was a North Yorkshire regiment. And so to this newcomer to military activities, there was this vast parade ground where you had down the far end of this lump of concrete, the 1st Battalion, the Green Howards, would what I would call assemble in the morning, and then you'd have this leader platoon of light infantry recruits, awkward looking devils that they were, up at the far end. And at that time there were 16 of us, and the 16 of us would be for that training period would be chased around by a couple of drill sergeants, and then you'd have a sergeant instructor on weapons, another one on field craft, another one on what I would call general duties. But there did, to this raw recruit, there did seem to be more NCOs, regular NCOs, than there did actual raw recruits.
So just take me back. So you remember arriving at the train station, getting in the truck. Do you remember arriving at the camp?
Vaguely.
What happened?
Well, we were all accommodated in spider accommodation, wooden huts.
Can you describe that for me?
Wooden huts, barrack rooms. So all 16 of us would be in one room, with the centre of the room being a massive black burner. Fortunately, it was in the summer, so there was no need to use the burner, and the weather was, you know, very suitable, very easy, very nice. I would hate to have been there in the winter. And we came from all walks of life, as you might say, backgrounds. We were all green, naive, didn't know what to expect. A mixture of public school boys and grammar school boys. And as always, you meet up and you have a rapport with one or two. And the little story behind the rapport of one or two was that I got very friendly with a fellow called Neville Pierce, trained solicitor, older than most of us, but again, he'd been nabbed for military service. Neville was even taller than I am. It must have been 6'4"-ish. And he and I used to knock around a great deal within camp, because we were confined to barracks for the first 3 weeks. It was considered we were unsuitable to go out outside the camp in uniform, because, you know, we just didn't represent light infantry. We were too awkward, too gawky, I suppose, to be submitted to the general public in the fair city of York. But of course, we got fed up in 3 weeks being, you know, after a carefree life at university, agricultural college, you know, being confined 3 weeks to one blessed place, being shouted at and abused, verbally abused, either on the parade ground or early in the morning, did not go down kindly.
So just talk me through what happened. So you're given the kit. at the beginning.
Yeah.
But do you remember getting your kit?
We were issued with the standard, what I'm called battle dress and fatigues, knife, fork, spoon, billy can, and all that nonsense. I can't remember the exact terminology of those many years ago, but it all seemed very crude. You know, I'd come from, I'd roughed it in a hostel in Denmark, but I'd come, as you might say, from a background where you had knives and forks and plates and cups and saucers and all the other paraphernalia, and that was all thrown out of the window, and it was, culturally, it was a big shock. Mentally, it was a big shock as well. And it was a case of, you know, really being thrown into the deep end and not liking it. And I suppose one of the reasons why they confined us to barracks, to the camp, for those 3 weeks was in case we would do a runner, which was quite possible. Nobody actually did, but there was always a possibility of somebody saying, well, I've had enough of this, away.
Talk me through a typical day.
Typical day. Oh, you would be up at 6, or Ravalli would be at 6. And then a corporal would come around making a lot of noise, making sure you're out of bed. You had to make your bed straight away. You had to be at breakfast with your knife, fork, spoon, and billy can, as I would call it, or a metal doofer and a metal mug by 7 o'clock, washed, shaved, dressed. And each of us had to take it in turns to be a junior NCO. In other words, there would be one person nominated to make sure we were ready to go across a quick march. Now, do you know anything about the light infantry?
Tell me for the
tape. Well, the light infantry march is 140 to the minute. Now, the normal regulation march for other infantry regiments is 120. So you're doing a very quick pace. And if you can imagine, I'm 6'2", and Neville Pearce, for example, he was 6'4". If you can imagine two big fellows amongst those 16 trying to do that quick step, quick march, it was comical to watch, but embarrassing to try and perform. So one of us would act as this acting unpaid junior NCO, and he would quick march us across to the canteen. You would have your cornflakes, and I think it was dehydrated milk. It wasn't cow's milk. Fried breakfast, tea, thick tea, strong tea, and you would have to be back standing by your beds, I think by 7:45, and then the real action would start, because the duty corporal, the duty corporals, all the NCOs, for that matter, all the commissioned officers, were from light infantry regiments. So I can always remember that two of the duty corporals, one was in the Duke of Cornwall's light infantry, in other words, they badged in the Duke of Cornwall's light infantry. Everybody wore the light infantry beret, which was a dark green. We wore what is known as a light infantry badge. In other words, we hadn't been badged into a unit or a regiment at that stage. So you had, he was a particular obnoxious individual, this Duke of Cornwall's corporal. And then there was another one from the Durham Light Infantry. Remember him, Corporal Parker. Had a bit more human side to him. Those are the two I remember. And then above them, you had what I would call the prime tormentor, Sergeant Lawless, of the Ox and Bucks Light Infantry. So we would come back to our barracks, stand by our beds, and one or either of the duty corporals would then get us on parade. And then Sergeant Lawless would go through the parade ground drill of the day, whatever it happened to be. Now, one of the problems that, and I mentioned Neville Pearce again, I reflect forward rapidly now. Neville Pearce, by the way, as I said, he was a solicitor, a gawky 6'4". Like me, had great difficulty on hearing command, in translating that command into the grey matter, down to the feet. So there would always be that split second pause where we would be behind everybody else. Now, being tall, we were often isolated out to be right marker. Now, right marker has to take, it'd be on the right-hand side of the squad of 16, and the right marker would have to take the necessary number of paces all on his lonesome, on the command from the drill sergeant, and be the right marker to bring the rest of the 15, as it was, the platoon, out on full parade in the centre of the parade ground. So you've got to remember that here you had 16 raw recruits from civilian life, many backgrounds. So you could, I would be chosen as right marker, or Neville most likely would be chosen as right marker. I think it was a form of torment by the NCOs in any case to pick us out, because they knew they'd have a good laugh quietly to themselves. And sometimes you'd look over on the parade ground, the far side, and the Green Howards, 1st Battalion, would be perhaps watching things and having a good laugh themselves. So it was like a circus in many respects, although we didn't always appreciate being the centre of this circus act. So getting on parade in those days, many years ago, was a torment for some of us. But, you know, you get through it, you laugh about it afterwards. And as usual, when you get a load of a group of young fellows together, and perhaps even young women, there's a lot of banter that goes on, leg pulling. So you just take it in your stride.
So drilling would be in the morning?
Drilling would be in the morning until about, it depends, I suppose, on the mood of the drill sergeant. I think it would be about until 10:30. And then we'd have a break, half an hour. Where you could get a cup of tea, I suppose have a cigarette if you're inclined to smoke. And these are the days where smoking was fully accepted. Come to think of it, it's funny how you think back now on the way you're prodding me in. Not many people in that particular platoon, as I remember it, used to smoke. So it was a cup of tea, and then around about 1100 hours, you could be taken on a number of more acceptable tasks. It might be weapons training, the rifle, 303, Sten gun, Bren gun, dismantling, inspecting, dismantling, putting it together, and all, you know, everything was repetition, repetition, repetition. Mulcock, Sergeant Mulcock was the instructor there, and we always had a high opinion of Mulcock. Sergeant Mulcock's experience had gone before him, and so he was a bit of a, I suppose, in that situation, he was a bit of a hero. He'd served in the Somerset Light Infantry in the Korean War, and this was his first posting back to the UK after his stint in Korea. So we would go out on the part of the ranges, say, in weapons training, and he would go. He was a very good instructor, kept it nice and simple, and knew how to get the best out of raw recruits.